Never go to the second location. Always trust your gut.
Hello, my name is Chrissy Champagne, and you are listening to Residue, a true crime podcast dedicated to keeping you paranoid. Today, we will be discussing one of my most requested cases. I know my first name is Steven, the TV miniseries that aired in 1989 about the life of Steven Stainer. Before we get into it, I just have to let you know that you can follow me on Instagram at Residue Podcast, Facebook at Residue A True Crime Podcast, and TikTok at Residue A True Crime Podcast. And do not forget that the most amazing thing you could possibly do for any podcast that you love is to leave a positive review. And oh my good God, do I have some great positive reviews this week. Thank you guys so much for writing to me in my DMs, for writing to me on Spotify, for getting Residue to Apple US top 200 charts. You guys are amazing. Thank you so much. And I just want to read to you a review that we received this week. And there were so many amazing ones here. I'm just going to kind of spin this little. I'm going to go through and just pick one. And we have this one. It says, love this, 5 stars. And the name is, please help me find a name. I'm going to call you Veronica because I always wanted to be called Veronica. And then my nickname would be Ronnie because of Heather's. Okay. So the review says, found Chrissy on TikTok and have been obsessed ever since. Love the way she tells stories, kind of like gossiping with your friend on the phone late at night, telling creepy stories. Thank you so much, Veronica, because that was the whole point when I started this podcast is I didn't have a co-host. I didn't want a co-host. I just wanted it to be like you guys were my co-host and I'm telling you a story. So that review made my day. Love it. Thank you so much. And thank you to everyone else who left amazing reviews. This is a complicated and very disturbing story. And as always, I have to warn you that listener discretion is advised. My two main sources for today's episode were the book, I Know My First Name is Steven by Mike Eccles, and also the Hulu documentary, Captive Audience, A Real American Horror Story. I Know My First Name is Steven is a 1989 television miniseries based on the true story of kidnapping victim Steven Stainer. This 2-part miniseries originally aired on NBC on May 22nd and 23rd, 1989. And following its U.S. broadcast, the miniseries was distributed internationally, with networks such as the BBC airing it in the mid-1990s, and it was later edited into a feature-length version for a wider release. The production received critical recognition, earning a nomination for Best Miniseries or Television Film at the 47th Golden Globe Awards, and it secured 4 Emmy nominations. And it also secured my teenage crush on Corin Nemec, who at the time was becoming this prominent teen heartthrob. He was such a versatile actor in the late 1980s and early 90s, and he was able to transition between these intense dramatic roles like Steven Stainer in I Know My First Name is Steven, landing himself an Emmy nomination for Best Actor. But then he also becomes a household name when he becomes the title character in the Fox TV sitcom Parker Lewis Can't Lose. I was obsessed with Parker Lewis Can't Lose, Corin Nemec, and Billie Jean. I mean, Teen Beat single-handedly wallpapered my entire bedroom back in the early 90s. Now, what makes this made-for-TV movie especially compelling is the existence of a Hulu behind-the-scenes docuseries called Captive Audience, A Real American Horror Story. And inside of this docuseries, they captured the screenwriter's creative process. So the screenwriter of I Know My First Name is Steven is J.P. Miller. And when he was writing this film, when he was creating this screenplay, he collected dozens of audio recordings as part of his writing process for this 2-part TV series. So he had recordings with the Stainer family, friends, and with Steven himself. And J.P. Miller believed it is most important to learn about the family in writing this screenplay. And you can hear JP himself saying that he needs to show Steven's legitimate fear. He needs to show this little boy as abused and confused without, quote, showing it on TV. I believe they did a fantastic job of showing the audience what happened to Steven without having to show it. Because Steven was kidnapped by an older man and held captive for 7 years. And in that time, this man sexually abused Steven. But in this made-for-television film, they weren't going to be able to show the audience that, and they didn't need to. And I'm not going to talk much about that part of it either, because that was a part that Steven didn't like to talk about. But Steven wanted this movie to be made because he thought that this could help other people. And it did. And that is the beauty of these made-for-television movies from the 80s and the 90s, is we didn't really know that things like this existed because we didn't talk about it. We didn't see it all the time like we do now. So a lot of times people will hear stories like this that happened in the 80s, the 90s, and they'll say, well, what was that parent doing? Why was that mother letting her child walk home from school every day by himself at 7 years old? It was a different time. And that's really the only explanation. But now movies like this get put out there and everyone's watching them. They're national news now, and people start to realize, oh my God, we have to take better precautions than we have been doing. We have to do things differently. And I know everything I just said came out very clunky, but the way that I'm just getting so, I get so worked up about it, because the reason I started this podcast was because these made-for-TV movies had such an effect on my life. I Know My First Name is Steven, The Cry for Help, The Tracy Thurman Story, A Killer Among Friends. These are the movies that changed my view of the world. Typically, I just tell you the true story behind the movie in the next segment, but I will be bringing up the made-for-TV movie quite often, because this made-for-TV movie actually had a huge impact on the Stainer family. Starring in the made-for-TV movie was Cindy Pickett as Kay Stainer, John Ashton as Del Stainer, Corin Corky Nemec as Steven Stainer, and Luke Edwards as Steven Stainer, age 7. And then we also had Todd Eric Andrews playing Carrie Stainer, Steven's brother. And as a special guest, there was also Steven Stainer starring as a cop in the Welcome Home Steven scene. I have to mention that in the Hulu documentary Captive Audience, Corin Nemec and then Todd Eric Andrews, who plays Carrie Stainer, they're both in this documentary, and they read lines that Steven and Carrie said. So they bring their characters back to life. And yes, I did say characters, but as you will see as we go along, not everything was the truth inside of the movie I Know My First Name is Steven. Early in the morning on December 4th, 1972, 7-year-old Steven Stainer got himself dressed for school and then ran down to the kitchen to enjoy a piping hot breakfast made by his mother, Kay. He had scrambled eggs, orange juice, and milk. His four older siblings, 3 sisters, Jody, Corey, and Cindy, and then an older brother, Carrie, they would all walk to school together. It was about a 12-block walk to get to the Charles Wright Elementary. Now, Corey was the youngest, and she didn't go to school yet, so she stayed home with mom, Kay, all day. And the older siblings, they usually stayed in school a little bit longer than Steven did. Steven got out of school at about 2 o'clock p.m., so although he would walk to school with his brother and sisters, he walked home alone most days. Delbert and Kay Stainer married in 1960 and had their 5 children. And together, the family had a passion for camping. And Kay reveals that her children were all different. Some of them were little helpers and some of them were troublemakers. They were raised in a really nice neighborhood and they had so many friends in the neighborhood. Kay says that Steven was her, quote, little helper, and he trusted everybody. He respected his elders. And his mom says that is exactly what got him into trouble. Now, on this day, December 4th, 1972, typically, Stephen would be walking home by himself, but Kay was out running some errands. She had to go to the auto parts store. She went to the grocery store. While she was at the grocery store, it started to rain. So she figured, okay, I'm going to go grab Stephen so he doesn't have to walk in the rain. She gets all the way to the school, and Stephen is not there. Now, what Kay did not know is that 80 miles away to the east, Irvin Murphy woke up that day. Now, Irvin Murphy is described as a, quote, skinny and hunch-shouldered simpleton. And this man, he was just dreading having to take the bus that day all the way to the Merced Mall to finish up some Christmas shopping. He never learned to drive, and the bus was his only way into Merced. So Irvin, and he's often called Murph by his friends, we'll call him Murph, was a kitchen cleaner at the Yosemite Lodge in Yosemite National Park. And Merced was the primary shopping destination for anyone in Yosemite. So that morning, he's dreading getting on the bus, but he hears a knock on his door, and it is his friend, Kenneth Parnell. He is a night auditor at Yosemite Lodge. Now, these two both worked for the Curry Company in Yosemite, and they were both described as the oddest of the collection of social misfits, ex-felons, and alcoholics at this company in Yosemite. Parnell is like, hey, let's go to Merced. Let's get in the car. Let's go. And Irvin's like, cool. So the two hop into Parnell's white Buick and they head to the Merced Mall. Now, inside the mall, Irvin does all of his Christmas shopping. He's just going about his little errands. And Parnell is buying gospel tracts, like little pamphlets that he can hand out. And he tells Murph, hey, since I give you a ride to the mall, I'm going to need you to help me hand out these gospel pamphlets to all of the kids at the school. Murph agrees to do this because Parnell gave him a ride, and he's also sort of known as Parnell's lackey. So later on, when Murph is interviewed by not only police, but by Mike Eccles for the book, I Know My First Name is Stephen, he says that he was just standing there in the sleet, handing out these gospel pamphlets, and you know, I gave a lot of them tracts, they called them gospel tracts, to them kids walking home from school. A lot of these kids would just say, hi, or I've got to get home. And pretty soon I had only a few of these gospel pamphlets left. And see, I'm handing them out and Stephen shows up and I'm talking to him and I said, where are you going? And he said, I'm going home. And I said, the minister will give you a ride home. And he points to Parnell. And then Parnell drives up and calls Stephen over to his car. He's like, hey, come here. Now, in Stephen's words, as he recollects this day, I don't remember too much about the school days, the usual monotonous days, but that one stands out. The walk home was usual, at least the first part. I walked down the back way and then crossed Yosemite Parkway, there by the gas station. At that age, I usually walked with my head down, looking at my feet, so I really didn't notice Murphy standing there until I was right on him. And then he came up to me and gave me some religious brochures. They had a little story in them and cartoons, and they said something of the Bible. Murphy said that he was from a church and he was trying to gather donations. And he asked me if maybe my mother would like to donate something to this cause. He asked me where I lived and I told him that I lived right around the corner, about 3 blocks. And then he asked, well, do you think we could speak with your mother? And I hadn't seen anybody else by then, but I said, yeah, I'm sure she would love to give you a donation. And then he goes, well, could you take us there? And Stephen agreed. He said that his impression was that he was a nice man. Stephen recalls that meeting Parnell. Parnell called himself Pastor Parnell. And he said, yeah, get in. I could give you a ride home. But he didn't drive Stephen home. He drove him straight to his house that night and said that he will call Stephen's parents and ask if Stephen can stay the night. Parnell actually says to this 7-year-old boy, oh, well, we're going to go to my place for a while and we'll see if you can stay the night. We'll call your mother and your father and we'll go from there. I'm sure your mother will let you stay the night. And Stephen says, but he doesn't want to. He wants to go back home and he wants to see his mother. Parnell insisting, well, we've got things to go do. We'll go back to my house and we'll call your mother from there. And this is when they hit the highway and they head to Parnell's house in Kathy's Valley. Okay, now Murph tells
author, Mike Eccles, that he didn't understand what was going on. He was completely confused about what was happening. He says, on the way out of Merced, I figured that there was something wrong. But then I said to myself, the kid ain't doing nothing. And I knowed that there was something wrong. But after we left Merced, I never heard Stephen cry. So he's figuring, oh, well, I don't really understand what we're doing, but Stephen's not really crying or putting up a fight, so I guess it's okay. Stephen is in some random man's car. His mother has no idea where he is. It's almost 4 p.m. Kay is losing her damn mind. The family is just running through the neighborhood, searching, asking neighbors. Kay calls Stephen's teachers, and she gets the phone numbers for every single classmate in Stephen's class. She's calling all of these parents. Has anybody seen Stephen? By this time, 5 o'clock p.m. rolls around, and the family calls the Merced police, and police arrive at their home. A description of Stephen immediately goes out, saying the subject was approximately 4 feet, 8 inches, 60 pounds, with shaggy brown hair and brown eyes, last seen wearing a tan coat and blue jeans and a possible zip-up type of shirt. And then an hour later, by 6 p.m., the reserve police officers and a local Boy Scouts were called in to help and search the area. So they're searching everywhere, including construction sites along Yosemite Parkway. But it was dark, it was cold, and everyone went in for the night. While the entire community is searching for Stephen, Stephen, Parnell, and Murph are sitting down to dinner at this little red cabin in Kathy's Valley. Parnell rented this as a private retreat from his bookkeeping duties at the Yosemite Lodge. Now, when these three did arrive at this little tiny getaway, hidden. I mean, it's a very quiet place to be. Nobody's around. Parnell told Murph that he cannot come inside right away. Parnell took Stephen inside by himself. And when he got Stephen inside of the house, he showed Stephen all of these little toys that he bought for him before he kidnapped him. And he had them sitting on the floor. And Stephen has no idea what's really going on. He's 7 years old. And he says, oh, can I take some of these toys to give to my brothers and sisters or my brother and sister? And Parnell got really angry and said, no, these are not for anyone else. These toys are only for you. Meanwhile, Murph says that he's standing outside, not knowing why Parnell makes him wait outside. It's freezing cold. He actually states, it was kind of chilly outside, but I stayed outside. And after a little bit, Parnell comes out and says, Murph, if you say anything about this, you'll be right in the same fix as me, and you'll get the same penalty I get. And then he says he was sorry he got Murph involved in any of this. But you agreed with me 100%, and if you tell anybody, you'll lose everything you have, Parnell told him. What Stephen didn't know is that this wasn't some random chance encounter. Parnell knew of the Stainer family. He says that he met this mailman. Now, this mailman, his route used to be on the Stainer's street. He used to deliver to their home. Now, this mailman gets transferred to Yosemite Park, and he meets Parnell, and these two start chatting it up. And, of course, a normal question that anyone would ask a new person they just met is, hey, on your mailman route, do you see any kids that are abused? Do you see any kids that might not be getting along with their family members? And this mailman's like, yeah, I do. I do know a kid. It's Stephen Stainer, the Stainer family. They abuse their children. Now, these are Parnell's words, okay? I can't for the life of me imagine that some man meets this creep-ass weirdo and he's like, yeah, I do know of children that are abused and they're having a random conversation. But I mean, nowadays, I don't put nothing past anybody with the shit that's been coming out and the things we've been hearing. So they're talking. Apparently, this mailman tells him that there's this little boy on the road. He's about 7 years old and on his route. And, you know, he's not very well taken care of. And so Parnell thinks, oh, this is possibly an option for me. So that is why he went to Merced that day. This night, and we're not going to get into the gritty details here, but this night is the first night that Stephen has to stay in this house. And Parnell tells him, listen, I already called your mom and dad. They don't really want you to come home. They think you should just stay with me. Now, he feeds Stephen dinner. The three of them sat down for dinner. Mind you, Murph is still in this house with them. He makes Stephen take a shower. Stephen comes out of the shower in just a towel. And then He makes Stephen get into the bed with him, naked. He makes him take off the towel and get into the bed with Parnell while Murph slept on a little chaise lounge right in the same area, because this is a tiny little cabin. And Murph will later tell police, you know what, that first night when I stayed in that cabin with them, that little boy didn't make a sound, and neither did Parnell. The very next day, Parnell tells Stephen that his parents still don't want him to come home. He tells him, hey, I called your parents and they want you to stay with me another night. And then he tells Stephen that he went to court to, quote, take possession of him, and that Stephen now belongs to Parnell. Stephen is his. Now, as I mentioned, these real things that happened to Stephen, they're going to be quite difficult to film for a made-for-TV movie. And this is when screenwriter J.P. Miller says, I had to show Stephen's legitimate fear. I had to show him as abused and confused without, quote, showing it on TV. So you'll notice in the movie, they have certain scenes where you just kind of hear a voiceover of the child playing Stephen Stainer saying that he's scared. And then they'll show Stephen awake in the morning, looking very out of it and very confused. So who was this Kenneth Parnell that kidnapped 7-year-old Stephen Stainer? Well, he was a convicted kidnapper and serial child offender. He was born in Amarillo, Texas, and his early life was really unstable. His father left the family when he was young, and he spent a lot of time in juvenile custody for crimes like theft and arson. And his criminal behavior escalated really early. In 1951, he impersonated a police officer to abduct and sexually abuse a young boy. And he served prison time for that crime, but he was released. And then he was later serving prison time for armed robbery, but he was released. And then this pattern of manipulation and abuse continued throughout Kenneth Parnell's entire life. Parnell is being taught over and over again that it does not matter what he does. He'll get a slap on the wrist. Yes, in 1951, he pretends he is a police officer and he rapes a little boy. And then he's only sentenced to 4 years in prison. So he sees what happens. I mean, 4 years in prison to him, that's nothing. He lured this child by pretending to be a police officer. And the whole thing with the Stephen Stainer story, even on the front of the book, it says, Stephen was taught to respect and trust his elders, and it nearly got him killed because all children were taught, you listen to your parents, you listen to your elders, and you definitely listen to police officers. And let me piss you off even more with this one. Parnell gave an interview about this 1951 crime where he impersonated a sheriff. He actually bought a fake badge from this army surplus store. So he impersonates this sheriff to get this little boy. And you want to know why? It was because Parnell was married and his wife was pregnant and that he, quote, had to find another outlet. I'm not going to go super deep into Kenneth Parnell's life because he's a piece of shit, but he claims that he had 3 wives. Records show that he only had 1 marriage. He did marry a 15-year-old named Patsy Jo Dornton in 1949, and they had a daughter together in 1951 and then were divorced by 1957. So he raped a little boy in 1951 and was still married until 1957. Now, there is a claim in the book, I Know My First Name is Stephen by Mike Eccles, that Parnell himself was molested around the age of 13, and this was by somebody that was staying in his mother's home when he was a teenager. But Parnell denies all of that, saying that he never said that, that never happened to him. So Parnell divorced in 1957, and then about a decade after the case in 1951 where he impersonated an officer, he was then convicted again of armed robbery, and this time in Utah. So apparently 3 different women married this piece of shit. I guess he had a second wife who divorced him while he was in prison for armed robbery, and then Parnell claims that he also had a 3rd wife that he married in 1968, but there have never been any records found that would provide proof that Parnell did marry a 3rd time. But now in 1972, Parnell has kidnapped 7-year-old Stephen Stainer and renamed him Dennis Gregory Parnell. and Stephen has to call Parnell dad. He's even putting him in school. He's enrolling Stephen as Dennis into school. Stephen's making friends in this community. He's living his life all under the assumption that his parents gave him away to this child molester. Parnell enrolled Stephen in school by using his real middle name and then his real birth date, and he would pass himself off as Stephen's father. And the two would move around frequently because the thing is Parnell, he can't let Stephen get too close to people and he can't be found out. So if Stephen did start getting close to people, to teachers, to friends, he would move him. They were living everywhere from Santa Rosa to Comanche. And Parnell wasn't your typical dad. So when Stephen would make new friends, especially as he was, you know, getting a little older, he's getting into junior high, he was allowed to drink and smoke. And these new friends that Stephen met would think, oh my God, Kenneth Parnell is a really laid back kind of dad, you know? And speaking of all of these new friends that Stephen made, so he really became close to a lot of kids and a lot of teachers when he was in Comanche. Now, this was a tiny little town, and a lot of these children who are now grown adults, they speak on the Hulu docuseries, and they talk about Dennis. One of the girls even asks the producers before she starts filming, should I call him Stephen or should I call him Dennis? Because I knew him as Dennis for years. I mean, one of these girls was Stephen's first girlfriend, his first love. Friend at school in Comanche, where Stephen and Parnell were residing at this point, said that their new friend Dennis was painfully shy, but he was so great, so friendly, and so chill. This was a small, close town. It was a very remote town where the kids had the run of the town, and the parents didn't worry about them. And a lot of people in town actually did not care for Kenneth Parnell. And a lot of the kids in town were told to never, ever go near Kenneth Parnell's house because, first of all, Kenneth Parnell is creepy. And also, he's letting his child, Dennis, drink and smoke and stay out all hours of the night. And Dennis was dirty. He didn't have clothes that fit him. His shoes had holes in them. He never wore socks. He was a dirty kid, and no one ever wanted to go to Dennis's house. Now, they didn't want to go to Dennis's house because Parnell was a creeper, but they loved Dennis. These children, as now grown adults talking in this documentary, are shedding tears. They're crying because they wish they knew what was going on. They wish that Dennis would have said something to them. They would have helped him, but he didn't say anything. And they are kind of kicking themselves for not noticing that something was off. Years are flying by. Stephen is living as Dennis Parnell. He has become Parnell's son. And meanwhile, the Stainer family is still trying their hardest to keep Stephen's story in the news, because Kay said that she knew that if you let this story fade, I mean, this is something that Adam Walsh's father, John Walsh, taught us. You cannot let the story fade from the media. She said that she would try her hardest to keep people talking about it, but the story just faded away. It wasn't the big news anymore. Kay says that she never left her home. She would never leave her house if someone else wasn't there because she needed someone to stay by that telephone in case Stephen called. She wanted someone to be home at all times. And Kay also says that so many tips were coming in. You know, as we hear in a lot of these cases, in every case, people are calling in fake tips. She said some of the tips included, she calls them, quote, ladies of the night. I'm not really sure about this tip, but she said a lot of tips were coming in from ladies of the night saying that they knew that Stephen Stainer was killed, chopped up, and then put into the sewers. Another man also came forward and said that he's the one that killed Stephen Stainer. Just so the family has some closure, Stephen Stainer is dead, and he wanted the family to be able to move on with their lives. But these tips would flash into the headlines every now and then, but they would never stay there for very long. And the Stainer family is starting to fall apart. The siblings are starting to ask Kay and Del what happened to Stephen, and they don't know what to tell them. It soon became the theme of this case is that nobody wants to talk about it. Everyone wants to keep things under wraps, hidden. Let's just not talk about it. Let's just move on with our lives and focus on what is happening right now. Corey Stainer, who was the youngest Stainer child, she said that she would often ask questions about Stephen. She wanted to know what happened. Why did this happen? And she wasn't given any answers. And then there was Carrie, the oldest Stainer child, who was a preteen at the time when Stephen disappeared. He understood what happened the most, but he would never talk about it. Later in interviews, Carrie Stainer would say of his father, Delbert, that he wasn't the dad that he was before Stephen was abducted. He used to be like the Rock of Gibraltar. And then all of a sudden, this one day, my little brother was gone and my dad was crying. And all of a sudden, I was like, oh my God, I never saw my dad have a tear in his eye in my whole entire life. Stephen's father, Del, was just very emotional during this time, and he was always set on the fact that Stephen was killed. He was not alive anymore. So Del would often just go around driving the streets, looking for fresh digs in the hills, in the dirt. And they had other children living in this home, so they had to get through this as a family. They couldn't just sit around and cry. But in his spare time, Del would still be out searching for his son. Years and years later, Stephen's youngest daughter, because yes, Stephen does end up having a daughter and a son, she says that it must have been so hard on my grandparents because you have to continue on with life or it'll just kill you if you don't. And that, to me, is what is so powerful about Stephen's story, because not only did Stephen's family have to figure out a new way of life, a new way to keep going, but so did Stephen. He was a completely new person, taken out of everything he knew as a 7-year-old child. And can you imagine? It's December 2nd, 1972. He's seven. He's getting ready for Christmas. He's so excited. You remember how excited you were about Christmas when you were seven? He has older brother and all of these sisters. He has a full family life. And now he is living in this little shack in the middle of nowhere, having to just go on. He had to go on as Dennis Parnell. And now Dennis Parnell's friends in this new town that he's living in, they're feeling like something is a little off with their friend. He's feeling really depressed. He's looking really depressed. They talk about this one time that all of the kids came back from Christmas vacay at school, and one night they all wanted to hang out, and they're being little teenage rebels, they're drinking beers, and they're just sitting there talking, and they ask Stephen about his mom. Did you get to see your mom for Christmas? And Stephen replied, my mom doesn't know I exist. And the friends didn't know. And looking back, they think, why did we not ask more questions? Why didn't we ask Dennis what that meant? I mean, they can't blame themselves. They had no idea that this young boy was kidnapped when he was 7 years old. I do believe that these tight-knit group of friends that Dennis made in Comanche would have helped him escape at some point if Parnell would have allowed them to stay in this town any longer. But Kenneth knew that Stephen was getting a little too close to these kids. He was really building himself a community in this town. He was getting too comfortable. So Kenneth needed to move again. They needed to find a more secluded spot. Now, I do have to mention that these years, as Stephen is growing up as Dennis, Stephen wasn't the only child that Parnell tried to abduct while Dennis was in the household. There was actually a period of about 18 months where Parnell was dating a woman named Barbara Matthias, and Barbara Matthias actually moved in with Parnell and Stephen. She knew what Parnell was doing, and according to Stephen, Barbara would often join in on these sessions that Parnell would have with Stephen. And she did nothing about this. She was a participant in all of this. And not only that, she would also try to abduct other children with Kenneth Parnell. In 1975, now this is 3 years after Stephen was abducted, Barbara tried to lure a young boy into their vehicle, just like they did with Stephen, and this young boy got away, so the attempt was unsuccessful. But Barbara later claimed that she was completely unaware of all of this, that she did not know that, quote, Dennis was kidnapped, and that she did not participate in any of this. I mean, this woman lived with them for 18 months. She was known as Stephen's caretaker during this time. And when Stephen was later interviewed by psychologists, he did tell them that he was uncomfortable with Barbara and the relationship that they had. And he was about 11 years old when this took place. So now Stephen is becoming a teenager and he's making a lot of friends, and it's just Dennis and Kenneth now, the Parnells, father and son, living alone. Kenneth takes Dennis and he moves him far away from Comanche because he was getting too comfortable with all of his friends. It's at this point that Parnell starts saying to Dennis, like, listen, we're going to get another kid. I want you to help me abduct another child. And Stephen said that Parnell would take him to Kmart sometimes and tell him, come into the store with me because we're going to go kidnap a boy in Kmart. And Stephen refused to get out of the car and help him. Stephen is getting older. He's becoming a man, and Parnell does not want this. Parnell wants a little boy. So one day, Parnell decides that he's going to ask one of Stephen's friends to help him, because he doesn't think that Stephen is a good accomplice. He's not going to be able to help him capture a little boy. So he promises the offer of drugs and money to this boy named Sean Poorman. And Sean Poorman agrees to help Parnell abduct a little boy. On February 14th, 1980, Valentine's Day, five-year-old Timmy White was abducted by Parnell and this kid, Sean, while walking home from school in Ukiah, California. Now, at the time of Timmy's abduction, Parnell had already given Stephen a gift, gave him a little dog that they named Queenie, but this dog was actually given to Kenneth by his mother as a gift, and Kenneth gave it to Stephen. Now, Kenneth's mother had no idea that Stephen even existed. She had no idea what her son was doing. So Stephen has this dog, and it's just Queenie, Stephen, and Parnell in this, you know, new home that they've built. And now Parnell is bringing home a new baby brother for Stephen, five-year-old Timmy White, who would be renamed Tommy. According to author Mike Eccles, now behind closed doors, Parnell was still committing these acts on Dennis, but the frequency was continuing to decline because Parnell was interested in little boys. And Dennis said that while they lived at this ranch, Parnell tried several times to kidnap a young boy. And so Dennis knew that this was coming. Stephen knew that this was coming. So when Stephen arrives home that day and he sees little Timmy White in this house, he knows he's got to act quick. He does not want this to happen to another boy. But back in Ukiah, California, Timmy White's mother, Angela, is going through the same exact situation that the Stainer family went through. She's realizing that it is past the time her son should be home. And she starts thinking, well, it is Valentine's Day, so maybe he's still at school. And she calls the school. He's not there. She's calling teachers. She's doing the same thing that Kay Stainer did. She calls police, and police come in right away. And now Timmy White's story is the focus of all of the news channels. On March 1st, 1980, a Saturday, Kenneth Parnell leaves for work. And now Stephen is home alone with little Timmy, and he decides to fix them some dinner. So he fixes the two of them bologna sandwiches. And then Stephen told Timmy to put on his jacket. He then went into his bedroom where his little dog, Queenie, was sitting on the floor. He bent down to Queenie and he whispered, "Do not worry, I will be back for you." He opened the front door, lifted Timmy up in his arms, and the two of them began their escape. Stephen and Timmy escaped Kenneth Parnell's house in the middle of the night, in the middle of nowhere, on a rainy, storming night with this long, treacherous road ahead of them. And Stephen knew that there was no way that they could walk this road. This was a horrible, scary road. They knew they were going to have to hitchhike. So Stephen tells reporters later that a Mexican guy picked us up and Timmy sat on my lap the whole way to Ukiah, California. They get to Ukiah and Stephen has this man drop them off at the police station. He gets into the police station and he says to an officer, "I know my first name is Stephen." On March 1, 1980, Stephen's family learns 7.5 years later that he is found. He is alive. Police arrive at the door of the Stainer's home, and immediately, Kay does not believe that this is going to be good news. She thinks that police are there to tell her that they found her son Stephen's body. And the parents immediately wanted to go see him. I mean, they're being told, "Your son is alive. We found him. He actually rescued another little boy. Stephen is a hero." And Kay and Del just wanted to go and get him quick. But the police said, "No, you cannot see your son yet." I mean, they waited 7.5 years. They're being told they have to wait because police needed to interview Stephen. They needed to get everything they could out of him to figure out what has been going on. And the Stainers admit that they were nervous. Kay says in an interview later for the Captive Audience documentary that she was nervous. She hasn't seen her son in over 7 years. He's almost a man now. This is a scary moment. It's almost like you have to meet your child all over again. And his siblings were so excited that they could barely sleep. They couldn't wait until Stephen came back home. I mean, nobody could wait. And this is one of the infamous scenes inside of the made-for-TV movie. This is the Welcome Home Stephen scene. And in real life, while making the movie, the actual Stephen Stainer plays a police officer in this scene. This is the scene. There are hundreds of people on the street. They're all waiting for Stephen's safe return. And Kay says that, I mean, there were people they didn't know, people they did know, the entire community. The place was a media circus. They hung a huge sign up that said, "Welcome home, Stephen." Everybody's waiting to see this hero. I mean, to the entire country, this was a happy ending. They didn't know what went on inside of that home with Kenneth Parnell for 7.5 years. And nobody wanted to talk about it. At first, the media wanted to make this seem like this is a happy ending. This little boy was kidnapped, possibly just by a man who just wanted a family. He just wanted little boys of his own. So that's how they're framing it at first. And Stephen's home, and he's enjoying the attention for a second. I mean, he's like, okay, he's happy, he's excited, he's home, but he just says to the media, he turns around and he's like, "Can you guys please leave me alone? I just want to be alone with my family." And you will see in many interviews that Stephen is very quiet. He's very polite, but he's very chill. He doesn't want a lot of attention surrounding him. He doesn't like this media circus or the mayhem. He just wanted to be inside of his house for the first time in 7 years with his family. And his mother, Kay, later admits that, yes, she did want to share Stephen's homecoming with the world because this is a happy moment. But in hindsight, she realizes that that ended up being bad because Stephen had to answer a ton of questions from reporters and he was terrified. Police stood by Stephen while he's being interviewed in front of his home. And, you know, the reporters are asking him all of these detailed questions about what happened to him inside of that house. And police are saying into his ear, "Don't answer that. Don't answer that question." They didn't want him to go into any details. But the interview requests, they were nonstop. Because as I said, this was the story. This was the feel-good story that everyone wanted to hear about. Yeah, on the forefront, this looks like it is a great feel-good ending, but it's not. Stephen endured a lot of shit inside of that house. But now, in front of the media, Stephen was a hero. He saved another child. He saved Timmy White. And one newscaster says, "Two boys are safe and well at home, and no one understands why they were taken in the first place." And that was so true. Nobody knew why this happened, and Stephen didn't want to talk about what happened. There were so many layers to Stephen's homecoming. He didn't know his family anymore, and they didn't know him. And he still would respond to the name Dennis. He was called Dennis for 7.5 years of his life. He sometimes would be sitting in front of the TV zoning out. His sister Corey said that Stephen zoned out a lot, and it almost looked like he wasn't there. And his mother would be going, "Stephen, Stephen," calling his name, and he wouldn't answer. And Corey remembers a time when his mother yelled, "Dennis," and Stephen turned around to answer his mother. Stephen also found it difficult that his father, Del, just couldn't adjust to the fact right away that Stephen was growing up, that he was grown up. He was 14 years old now, and his father was still dealing with him as though he was the 5-year-old child or the 7-year-old child that was kidnapped 7.5 years ago. So Stephen's home, and he's dealing with a lot of awkwardness. He's dealing with a lot of media. He's just trying to figure out how to now, once again, go on with his life in a completely new format. Now he's being called Stephen, and he's home, and he has to go back to school, and he has to start a routine. He's starting 9th grade, and the media will not leave him alone. The media follows him everywhere he goes, and it seemed as though Stephen was sort of oblivious to the media, like he just got so used to it. Reporters were just bombarding him at school. He'd be in the middle of walking to class, and reporters are walking right up to him, right on the school campus, shoving mics in his face. And not only that, he was really behind in school. He needed tutoring. And it definitely was not easy for Stephen to make friends again. These kids resented him. They resented him for all of the attention that he was receiving. Stephen needed tutoring, but he also needed therapy. But he wasn't receiving the therapy that he needed, because back then, the mindset was, you know, you do not let other people know your business. You don't need to talk about what happened to you. You don't need to let anyone know what happened to you. And believe me, Stephen did not want to talk about what happened to him. He's already feeling like an outcast. He's already being bullied by these kids at school. He definitely doesn't want anybody to know what Kenneth Parnell did, and he is not talking about it. Stephen's siblings were annoyed with the constant attention. They were jealous of Stephen. His older brother, Carrie, even said in an interview, he was just a normal, everyday kid, and the media blew it out of proportion with this hero thing. The way I see it, anyone would have done what Stephen did. And I guess I am just jealous. While Stephen is back home and he is trying to navigate his family life, his school, the media being a constant presence in his life at all times, Parnell was awaiting trial. Parnell was tried for kidnapping Stephen Stainer and Timmy White, but he was not tried for sexual abuse. The reporters, they would always try to get Stephen to talk, and they would ask him things like, "Did he ever hurt you?" Stephen would say no. "Did he ever try to?" And Stephen would say no. I mean, the media said that maybe Kenneth just wanted sons, and this was the only way. And the friends and neighbors of Dennis Parnell said that, yeah, Kenneth and Dennis, they did seem like father and son. So maybe this really was Kenneth Parnell's motive, because why would anyone want to do this? Like, nobody could fathom that this man was a predator, that he was a child molester that had already spent time in prison for raping a child. But nobody talked about that. Stephen said, "What happened was, I didn't want to talk about it. And when the police asked me if there was any abuse, I said no. People just figured that Parnell wanted a family." But then the pictures of Stephen showed up. Polaroid pictures of Stephen were found in Kenneth Parnell's cabin. And the rumors of the molestation come out into the public, and everyone knows about it. Now, the family was adamant that Stephen was not going to talk about this, that nobody was going to talk about the molestation or anything that went on inside that home. But Kay said that the media wanted to know the, quote, nitty-gritty. I mean, the charges against Kenneth Parnell were conspiracy and lewd and lascivious acts against a child. Even one of the lawyers stated that, "I think it'd be embarrassing for Stephen to have to say these things in front of the public, so naturally, this should not be publicized." But on June 8th, 1981, Kenneth Parnell was sentenced for just the Timmy White abduction, and he was given 7 years. Again, just like the 1951 rape of a child, he's given 7 years. Do they think that when he leaves prison that he's going to be a changed man and that he's going to go, "You know what? I guess I don't like kidnapping little boys." When will we learn to keep these pieces of shit in prison? Now Parnell is to be sentenced for Stephen Stainer, and Stephen is nervous. He doesn't want to talk about it. He doesn't want to get up there in front of everybody and tell them anything that happened to him. He has to admit that Parnell forced him to perform sodomy and oral sex acts. And for this, Kenneth Parnell was sentenced to 7 years. But this was the second offense he was being tried for, so he was only required to serve a third of that. Your mind is blown, I know. Kenneth Parnell spent less time in prison than Stephen Stainer spent locked up in his house. Stephen Stainer endured 7.5 years of abuse at the hands of this man. And the courts were like, 7 years, that's it. And it was not easy for Stephen to continue after this trial because now the kids at school knew everything and the kids at school bullied him even harder. Having everybody know this information about him, having lived through the trauma he went through, not getting the proper therapy, not being able to talk about this with anyone, Stephen started drinking a lot and smoking and taking pills. And his mother, Kay, says that the next 4 to 5 years of Stephen's life was just beyond chaotic. She couldn't figure out how to control him, how to turn him around. But that was until he met a girl named Jody Edmonton. And now, in the made-for-TV movie, they portray Jody as this girl who was popular, and all the people were picking on Stephen in school, and Jody stepped in and defended him. But that is not how these two met. This was a Hollywood storyline. Jody actually met Stephen because he was working at a butcher shop with one of her girlfriends, and her friend was like, "Hey, you should meet this guy Stephen. He's really cool." Stephen and Jody fell in love. And Jody says that Stephen was this eerily calm person that they met when she was 16 and he was 19. And he was the type of person that just went straight for what he wanted. He never minced words. He just walked right up to her and said, "Do you want to go out with me? Take you on a date?" And she was like, "Yes." And when they fell in love, Stephen was ready to settle down. He was in love. He wanted to start a family. And very quickly, Jody gets pregnant with their daughter, Ashley. And then very soon after that, they have a son that they name Stephen Jr. And everybody says that Stephen was the greatest father. If there's one thing you want to remember about Stephen, it's that he was a great husband and a great father. Now, screenwriter J.P. Miller, who brought Stephen's story to the screen, he conducted hours of interviews with this family. He wanted to make sure that he had everything he needed to know about this family, because he wanted the audience to know what kind of family Stephen came from. Now, J.P. Miller, he also wrote the made-for-TV movie Helter Skelter. Now, the family liked that J.P. was the one that wanted to recreate their story about what happened to Stephen, because they enjoyed this movie Helter Skelter. They felt like he was a reputable guy. Apparently, I cannot say reputable. I'm just going to leave that in to show you that we're all human and we make mistakes. So Kay did not want Stephen's story to be made because she did not want it to be sensationalized. But Stephen wanted it to be made, and he really wanted this money from this movie in his pocket. And Kay even notes in the documentary that he wanted a motorcycle. So The movie's going to be made. J.P. Miller interviews the family for weeks, for months. He's getting to know these people. And when the movie's ready to be filmed, they invite the entire family out to L.A. to meet the cast and the crew. And Steven got to meet Corin Nemec. He said he looked exactly like he did when he was a teenager. I mean, they treated this family like royalty. They even had director's chairs made for all of them, even the siblings. So when the movie was being made, Steven Stainer was actually 23 years old, married with two kids. He was going to law enforcement school. He wanted to be a cop. And so that's why the filmmakers, they let him play a cop in the Welcome Home Steven homecoming scene. So the Stainers are stoked. This movie's going to be so amazing. But then the movie airs. On May 22nd and May 23rd, 1989, this movie aired in two parts to 40 million viewers. Now, this was unheard of in 1989. This was like, Corin Nemec says that this was like the Super Bowl kind of viewers. And they ask Steven in an interview, do you like the movie? Do you like the way that Corin Nemec played you? And Steven said, you know what? I really like Corin. He's cool. Cool guy. But I gotta tell you, they didn't really make Steven like me. Because in the movie, Steven talks back a lot and Steven is very rude to his parents, and I would never talk back or ever be rude to my parents. And his mother Kay said that she was not impressed with this movie at all because it depicted the family different. They depicted the family as, quote, twisted and ridiculous. And actually, Delbert was pissed off beyond belief. Kay says that the family was never as, quote, destitute as the movie was portraying them to be. So, I mean, the way they portrayed the family to be kind of down and out on their luck, kind of poor, Del just couldn't deal with this. And he was also the type of person back then, he didn't want anybody knowing the family's business. He didn't believe in therapy. Steven's mother says that he wanted this movie to serve a purpose. And it did. The movie was also a huge success. It was nominated for 4 Emmy Awards, and Corin Nemec blows up. He becomes the next big thing. And the cast and crew, they're stoked. The Emmys are about to happen. Corin Nemec is nominated for Best Actor. And the night before the Emmys are on TV, Steven Stainer died in a motorcycle accident. On a Saturday night, Steven Stainer was returning home from work, and a guy in a car pulled out in front of him while he was on his motorcycle, and Steven died at the scene. It was a hit and run. Steven's sister, Corey, was actually on her way to work, and she passed this scene, and she saw the ambulance, and she saw people working on this person laying on the ground, and she did not know that it was her brother. Steven's funeral was packed. There were so many people there to honor this hero. Of course, the media was there, and Steven's wife, Jody, said that it always seems like when something happens in our family, the media is there. Steven Stainer was kidnapped in December of 1972, and he died on September 16th, 1989, at the age of 24. There were over 500 people in attendance at Steven Stainer's funeral, and Timmy White was a pallbearer. Now, Steven's young daughter, Ashley, was only in preschool when he died. And she remembers at the funeral, she went outside and she saw a balloon in the air, and she thought, that balloon is going to go up to my dad. Ashley recalls that as she grew up, their family never talked about it. They never talked about Steven and what happened. They stayed silent and they held in all of their emotions. And Ashley says that her mother, Jody, had to move on. She tried to move on, but she married a man, and Steven Jr. and Ashley ended up hating their new stepdad. They didn't like him because he didn't like the Stainers, which in turn meant that Ashley and Stephen Jr. rarely saw their grandparents, and Ashley didn't know that there was a movie made about her father. She had no idea that "I Know My First Name Is Stephen" existed. She was around 8 years old when she was spending the night at a cousin's house, and her cousin said, "You know there's a movie about your dad, right?" And Ashley was like, "No." And her cousin showed it to her, which reminds me of the Diane Downs case, when Diane Downs' daughter finds out that her mother was in a movie, or they made a movie about her mother called Small Sacrifices. Somebody else showed these children these movies that they probably shouldn't have been watching at this age. I mean, Ashley watched her father's movie at age 8, and she said that she didn't really get it, that it was sort of stomach turning, and she didn't want to see her dad that way because he was so little when he was kidnapped, being portrayed in this movie, and he was hurting in the movie. And she said that as she grew older, and this part always brings a little tear to my eye, is that whenever she would see Corin Nemec in a movie, on screen, she would think that's her dad. So she would always associate Corin Nemec as her father, Stephen. After Stephen died, terrible things start happening to this family, and you start to think, are you kidding me? How much more could happen to one family? Now, when making the made-for-TV movie and writing out the screenplay, screenwriter J.P. Miller stated to his crew, "Hey, listen, we're going to make this a two-parter. And if we're going to make this a two-parter, then we're going to have part one end on a cliffhanger." So in the tradition of J.P. Miller, and "I Know My First Name Is Stephen," that's what I am going to do to you guys today, because this is part one and we are going to end on a cliffhanger. Stephen Stainer's brother, Kerry, said, "I didn't need to be loved that much, but why couldn't I be loved a little bit like Stephen was loved? Do you think Stephen's life is something? Well, wait until you hear my life." That's right, you guys. There is so much more to tell you. This story is beyond unbelievable. If you haven't already, don't forget to hit that follow button so you can return next Tuesday to hear the story of Kerry Stainer. Residue is created, hosted, written, researched, edited, and produced by me, Chrissy Champagne. Do not forget to hit that follow button so you can meet us back here next Tuesday. And if you did enjoy Residue, please consider leaving a positive review. Stay safe and stay paranoid. Bye, guys. Residue crew forever.